Hello and happy 4th of July. This is Ian Berg with the commercial news dated Wednesday, July 4th, 2018. We'll start today's reading on the front page of the paper with the article, Council Approves School District Agreements, by Jennifer Bailey. Danville. The Danville City Council Tuesday night unanimously voted by an 8-0 vote approving three intergovernmental agreements between the City and Danville District 118. Aldermen who were absent were Rick Strebing, R.J. Davis, Mike O'Kane, John Cooper, Mike Purr, and Tom Stone. In the short meeting, the Council approved the agreements laying out having four school resource officers, with two at Danville High School and one each at Kenneth D. Bailey Academy and Northridge Middle School, and procedures allowing the city emergency access to school security video feed and radio frequencies, and also for reciprocal reporting of criminal offenses committed by students. "To me, it's sad that we need them," said Ward 1 Alderman Ricky Williams Jr. Ward 7 Alderman Lloyd Randall, as Ward 2 Alderman Dan Dutchin last week, wanted to make sure parents and students' rights and privacy would also be protected. Danville Public Safety Director Larry Thomason said they look at the security of the school and enforcement according to statute. The council also heard again from firefighters about the expected awarding of a staffing for adequate fire and emergency response, or SAFER, grant for six firefighters. Mayor Scott Eisenhower said the plan is to bring information, if officially notified and received in the next couple weeks, to the July 24th Public Services Committee meeting for possible action on the grant. Ward 3 Alderman Sherry Pickering also brought up the one-year anniversary of the East Main Street Fire Station closing this past weekend. She noted it took firefighters 12 minutes to reach the McLean Midwest Fire Friday night. In other business, the council authorized the Danville Public Building Commission to replace heating and ventilation and air conditioning system at the Juvenile Detention Center. The project will be added to the bond issue project list. They also approved a $15,000 budget amendment for Harrison Park Golf Course due to repairs from flooding. Funds come from golf course reserves. We'll continue down the front page with the article, A Dollar and a Handshake. Child Buys His Own Plot of Farmland, by Mary Wyckoff. Elvin. If the critters don't eat them, Cole Dines estimates a yield of 40 pumpkins this fall. With his newfound farmer's wisdom, the nearly 6-year-old already has plans to nurture the pumpkins and sell them in the fall. It's a dream come true for the child, who has talked about becoming a farmer since he could talk. Last week, Cole and his grandmother, Terry Dines, nailed an orange sign, Cole's Farm, to a tree at the edge of his future pumpkin patch south of Alvin. Otherwise, Cole isn't very chatty with strangers when it comes to talking about his passion for agriculture. When asked why he wants to be a farmer, he just shrugged. Finally, he admitted it would be fun to drive a truck, a tractor, and a combine. Then, he ran off to play with his brother, Drew, and his great-grandpa's dog, Sonny. Dines said her grandson, who lives near Fairmont, is set on becoming a farmer. "I think he has always loved the tractors and all the machinery," she said. "He always plays like he is farming or building a farm. I think living rural has rubbed off on him." One day, Cole told her, "We need to get my farmland now." So, Dines and her father, Bill White, 92, a retired farmer, came up with a plan to sell the child some land. White designated about a quarter of an acre near his home off Illinois Route 119, just south of Alvin. Dines, who was clerk for the village of Alvin, drew up some official-looking papers, turning the land over to the child. Cole handed over $1 from money he had saved in his bank and shook his great-grandfather's hand. Kyle Finley plowed the land, and Cole later will plant the seeds for Minnie and jack-o'-lantern pumpkins. Cole would be considered fifth-generation farming the land. His great-great-grandfather, Charlie White, bought the ground in 1875. White is proud of his great-grandson wanting to carry on the farming tradition. "I'm glad to see the young generation taking up stuff like this," he said. However, he cautioned, he has a rough road to travel. The weather has been severe in recent years, and technology is constantly changing. White said he's seen so many changes in his own lifetime that he can only imagine what Cole, the future farmer, may experience. He'll probably be sitting in his home while automated machinery does all the work. Dines agreed, saying, by the time he's ready to farm, there will be robots. White also joked that Cole will have to pay taxes on his land, but great-grandpa plans to help out. White has 160 acres of land, which someone else farms. However, he still tends to about 40 rows of sweet corn, which he sells from his home every summer. Also, he knows everything there is to know about lawnmowers, and buys, sells, and repairs them. Cole will be in kindergarten this fall at Catlin Elementary School. His brother Drew will be in second grade, and sister Lexi is 4. They are the children of Kyle and Heather Dines of rural Fairmont, and the grandchildren of Terry and Bob Dines of Alvin. Cole's parents think his passion for farming is great, and they already have people wanting to buy pumpkins. Continuing on the front page, we'll go to the article, Enjoy Shows, But Stay Safe. While you can't buy fireworks beyond sparklers and snake charmers in Illinois, it's still important to make sure this 4th of July is safe for everyone, from your kids to your pets. Illinois State Police District 10 Commander Captain Louis Kink said in a press release that driving under the influence remains the number one cause of fatal crashes during Independence Day celebrations. There will be a lot of traffic this weekend, and we want everyone to be mindful of the other vehicles on the road. You may be a great driver, but the driver next to you may be impaired, distracted, tired, etc., Kink said. Please remember to slow down and move over for stationary emergency vehicles and stranded motorists. Help us keep our roads safe for everyone. The ISP said to plan a safe way home before beginning 4th of July festivities, and if a drunk driver is on the road, call 911. Blaine's Farm and Fleet also released a statement to keep pets safe. If you plan on attending any of the city or village organized fireworks displays, you are advised to keep pets at home. Because some dogs may be frightened of fireworks and try to run away, it's also a good idea to ensure their identity tag and microchip information is up to date. While the Illinois Pyrotechnic Use Act forbids the sale, possession, and use of almost all fireworks, the use of commercial fireworks are allowed for those with permits. The Illinois State Fire Marshal claims even sparklers can cause severe burns if they aren't handled properly. They also noted that spectators should stay in the viewing area, far from the fallout area where the debris may fall. Above all, be sure to enjoy fireworks from a safe distance and don't hesitate to call 911 in case of emergency. We'll continue now with the article, Gambling Could Put Athletes at Risk, by Sean Isabella from CNHI Sports. Longtime Las Vegas oddsmaker Kenny White stumbled into the role he holds today. White, Vice President of Data Integrity at Don Best Sports, whose clients include the Big 12 Conference, owned Las Vegas Sports Consultants, a company that provided odds and betting information to sportsbooks. He began receiving complaints from his clients how they were consistently getting destroyed on Mid-American Conference football and basketball game wagers from 2004 to 2006. White says he dedicated resources to constructing more competitive lines, but his clients ran into the same problem the following year. In trying to figure out what was wrong, he unearthed what appeared to be suspicious activity at the University of Toledo. Turns out he was right. Eventually, 7 former Toledo football and basketball players were tried, convicted, and received various sentences of probation and fines. Incidents like the one in Toledo and other NCAA gambling scandals throughout the years have resurfaced how, now that the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that states have the authority to legalize sports and gambling. Amateur athletes are at the highest risk because there are no paychecks. They don't make any money, White said. They get a stipend a month, and a gambler throws down $10,000 in front of them and says, "Fix one game. You don't even need to lose, just don't cover the point spread." There's a pretty good chance they do it. As Delaware and New Jersey take their first bets, with Mississippi, West Virginia, and Rhode Island looming next, other states are left to wonder the impact it will have on college athletics. To date, the NCAA hasn't said much beyond the statement released from its president, Mark Emmert, a few days after the Supreme Court decision. In that statement, Emmert said the NCAA supports a federal model on legalized sports gambling. "While we recognize the critical role of state governments, strong federal standards are necessary to safeguard the integrity of college sports and the athletes that play these games at all levels," Emmert said. Emmert also expressed some concerns about the impact on student athletes. "Our highest priorities in any conversation about sports wagering are maintaining the integrity of competition and student-athlete well-being," Emmert said. "Sports wagering can adversely impact student athletes and undermine the games they play. We are committed to ensuring that laws and regulations promote a safe and fair environment for the nearly 500,000 students who play college athletics." Several sports gambling experts told CNHI it would make sense for the NCAA to get ahead of the situation, since legalized sports gambling at the amateur level is inevitable. Jake Williams, general legal counsel for the U.S. branch of Sport Radar, a European sports data and integrity company, said less than 1% of the 400,000 matches the company covers are deemed to have suspicious betting or likely to be fixed. Still, he acknowledged how susceptible college athletes are. To help alleviate problems, Williams suggested the NCAA, along with member schools, beef up corruption and integrity units and invest in education and monitoring. "To ignore and not educate those types of athletes is going to be problematic in the long run," Williams said. "I hope the conferences, the schools, and the NCAA understand the scope and the breadth of what's required and actively participate in making sure they're doing everything they can to protect their athletes. In addition to research from the NBA and other professional leagues, he also serves as a consultant for Sportsline, a division of CBS Sports. He said he has done oversight for the NCAA, the Big 12, and three other college conferences he did not name. He explained that he uses algorithms and formulas to monitor point spreads that raise flags for 7 or 8 different categories. White said he knows it doesn't take much for a college player to veer off the wrong path. If they do it once, that's it. They're done, he said. They're going to do it forever. The bookies will never let them out of it. That's what the kids don't understand. Then there's the topic of how prevalent sports betting is on college campuses. A 2016 NCAA study of nearly 23,000 student athletes found 55% of men reported gambling for money and 24% reported violating NCAA bylaws by wagering on sports for money. 11% of Division I football players and 5% of men's basketball players reported betting on a college game in their sport, not involving their team. If colleges truly did not want gambling, they would lobby to make all gambling lines on college sports illegal, said David Ridpath, an associate professor of sports management at Ohio University. It has to be an either-or, not just, "Hey, it's illegal, we know what's going on, and, man, we make a ton of cash, but we can look the other way." Ridpath spent 7 years in athletic compliance at Marshall University and Weber State University. He described gambling safeguards in place at the time as a whack-a-mole. He said schools used in-person education, newsletters, emails, and specific educational moments during high-potential gambling times such as March Madness. Purdue Athletic Director Mike Bombinski told CNHI the school already discusses gambling and point shaving with student athletes, but he said they'll have to be more diligent, comprehensive, and intentional moving forward in order to protect integrity. "Once you lose that, you're shot," Bombinski told CNHI. "If people don't trust what's happening in front of them is legit, you can't get away with it." For those concerned with integrity, Sarah Slane, Senior Vice President of Public Affairs at the American Gambling Association, argued the more transparent and regulated a sports betting system is, the better equipped a league, in this case the NCAA, is in detecting when something goes awry. We'll go now to the death notices. Wilma Ruth Ellis, 85, of Potomac, passed away on Saturday, June 30th, at Arbor Rose of Tolono. A service to celebrate the life of Wilma Ellis will be at 11 a.m. on Saturday, July 7th, at Potomac Church of Nazarene. Burial will follow at Potomac Cemetery. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. on Saturday, prior to the service at the church. Memorials may be made to Potomac Church of Nazarene or to the Alzheimer's Association. Rosemary Rosie Reed, 87, of Hoopston, passed away at 11:35 p.m. on Sunday, July 1st. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, July 5th, at Anderson Funeral Home at 427 East Main Street in Hoopston. The funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, July 6th, at the funeral home. Burial will follow in Floral Hill Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the donor's choice. Heath Huffman, 36, passed away on Monday, July 2nd, at his residence in Napanee, Indiana. Funeral arrangements are visitation at Thompson, Legature, and Yoder Funeral Home in Napanee on Saturday, July 7th, from 2 to 4 p.m. Visitation at Diverter Funeral Home will be on Sunday, July 8th, from 3 to 7 p.m. Burial will be at 10 a.m. Monday, July 9th, at the National Cemetery in Danville with military rites. Ellen Williams, 61, of Tampa, Florida, passed away on June 25th. A celebration memorial service will be at 4 p.m. Eastern on Saturday, July 7th, at Sunset's Covington Chapel at 420 3rd Street in Covington, with Pastor Matt Flitsky officiating. Visitation will be from 2 to 4 p.m. on Saturday prior to the service at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to SHAMC. Dorothy Tinsley, 72, of Danville, passed away on June 24, 2018. Per her request, she will be cremated, services pending. Patricia Marie Pat Bowling, 77, of Vetersburg, passed away on Monday, July 2, 2018. Funeral service will be at 1 p.m. on Friday, July 6th, at Sterling Christian Church at 701 South Sterling Avenue in Vetersburg. Visitation will also be at the church from 5 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, July 5th. Burial will be at Rockfield Cemetery. Memorial contributions to St. Jude's Children's Hospital. Phil Shilato, 63, of Rochester, passed away on July 2, 2018. Memorial contributions may be made to the ALS Association, Rochester High School Soccer, or My Furry Valentine. Catherine Kathy Rogers, 71, of Ridge Farm, passed away on Saturday, June 30, 2018. A celebration of Kathy's life will be at 2 p.m. on Thursday, July 5th, at Sunset's Houghton Leisure Funeral Home at 200 East West Street in Georgetown. Visitation will be from noon to 2 p.m. on Thursday, prior to her service at the funeral home. She will be laid to rest in Crown Hill Cemetery in Ridge Farm. Memorial donations may be given in her name to Mills Cancer Center in Urbana, Illinois. Lonnie Gail Free, 61, of Catlin, Illinois, passed away on June 29, 2018. A visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, July 5th, at Sunset Funeral Home at 3940 North Vermilion Street. The family asks everyone to please wear Gail's favorite color, Kentucky Blue. Services will be at 11 a.m. on Friday, July 6th, and graveside service to follow at Floral Hill Cemetery in Hoopston. Donations can be made in his honor to American Cancer Society, or the donation of the gift of life by signing up to be an organ donor to help save lives, as Gail did. Esther Mae Thompson Hill, 102, of Danville, Illinois, formerly of Taylorville, passed away on Saturday, June 30th, 2018. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. on Saturday, July 7th, at Sutton Memorial Funeral Home in Taylorville. Funeral service will follow the visitation starting at 11 a.m. at Sutton Memorial Home in Taylorville. Burial will be in Liberty Cemetery in Brownsville, Illinois. Martin Mullen, 59, of Westville, Illinois, passed away on June 29th, 2018. As per his wishes, he was cremated. A celebration of Marty's life will be at 11 a.m. on Saturday, July 21st, at American Legion Post 203 in Georgetown. Dorothy E. Bennett, 91, of Tilton, passed away on Friday, June 29th, 2018. A celebration of Dorothy's life will be at 11 a.m. on Thursday, July 5th, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center at 3940 North Vermilion Street in Danville. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. on Thursday prior to the service at the funeral home. She will be laid to rest in Sunset Memorial Park. Memorial donations may be made in her honor to the donor's choice. Margaret Garrison, 78, of Georgetown, passed away on June 30th, 2018. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. on Friday at St. Mary's Catholic Church at 231 North State Street in Westville. Burial will be in St. Peter and Paul Cemetery in Westville. Visitation will be from 10 to 10:30 a.m. on Friday at the church. Rosary service will be at 10:30 a.m. at the church. We'll continue now on page 2A of the paper with the article "Truck Fire, Candy Spill Closes I-74 Exit Ramp" from Carol Rome. Oakwood. A semi-trailer truck full of Laffy Taffy caught on fire Monday morning and shut down the eastbound Interstate 74 exit ramp at Oakwood for a few hours. Illinois State Police Trooper Tracy Lillard said the back tires of an eastbound Nestle truck caught on fire on I-74 around 8 a.m. Monday. The truck fire eventually caught the truck's trailer on fire, prompting the driver to pull over onto the Oakwood exit ramp. Lillard said a female volunteer firefighter from Westville happened to be traveling behind the truck when it caught on fire and called 911. Because of her actions, the fire department was able to get there quicker, she said. An excavator was used to pull the side of the trailer open, causing the Laffy Taffy to spill out onto the ramp. Lillard said it's not uncommon to open up a semi-trailer during a fire, so firefighters can make sure the fire is extinguished inside the trailer. No injuries were reported during the incident. The ramp was reopened to traffic after a couple hours. However, cleanup crews came back later Monday afternoon to remove the debris. When there is an accident like that, they offload everything to the side of the road, and recovery agents come back later in the day to clean it up, Lillard said. Their priority is to reopen the lane of traffic. We'll continue next with the article, "Oakwood Seeks Volunteers for Ambulance Service." Oakwood, by Carol Rome. The Oakwood Village Board discussed last week the need for additional volunteers to help maintain the village's all-volunteer ambulance service. "We're always looking for individuals who will step up and be a first responder, or EMT," Oakwood Mayor Clay Woodard said. The village's ambulance service has approximately 20 volunteers on its roster who are compensated per run. However, Woodard said he would like to see a few more volunteers join the ambulance service. "It's getting harder to maintain a volunteer ambulance service," Woodard said, pointing to Moequa's decision to shut down its community ambulance service in May after more than 20 years of service, due to a lack of volunteers. "We've been fortunate so far at keeping the staffing levels where they ought to be," he said. "We're still making money, still breaking even and providing a quality service for our residents." Also during the special meeting on June 28th, the village board denied a request by the Liquor Box to amend the village's liquor ordinance on July 3rd, only that would have allowed all liquor establishments in Oakwood to extend their hours to from 2 a.m. from midnight. "They voted not to amend the requirements for that one night," Woodard said. "The board wanted to adhere to the ordinance." They also discussed the police department's hours. Woodard said the village's two full-time officers, Police Chief Josh Bennett and Officer Derek Weston, currently work 10-hour days. "We talked about moving them to 8-hour days and having a third officer," Woodard said. Now for a little bit in local sports, we'll head to page B1 for the article, "Same Old Story, Danville Falters in All Phases, Drops Fifth Straight," by Chad Dare. Danville. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. The credit for that quote has been attributed to more than one person, including Albert Einstein. But it doesn't take a genius to realize that in the game of baseball, issuing walks, committing errors, and not hitting the baseball is a recipe for a losing streak. That's what continues to happen for the Danville Dans. On Tuesday night, the Dans suffered their fifth straight loss, this time losing to the Terre Haute Rex 11-4. As Danville issued 9 walks, committed 5 errors, and managed just 6 hits. "Nothing changes and you get your butt kicked," Danville manager Eric Coleman said. "That's what happens when you don't make adjustments at the plate. You don't make adjustments playing defense. And you don't compete in the strike zone. When those things happen, you give up double-digit runs like we did tonight." The ugly performance for the Dans started in the first inning. Danville starter Ryan Horter, who came into the contest with a 0.00 ERA in 8.2 innings, walked the first two batters and hit the third, Jarrett O'Leary, to load the bases. After back-to-back strikeouts of Robbie Enriquez and Chris Wellen, it looked like Horter was going to wiggle out of the jam when a 3-2 pitch to Justin Jenkins appeared to catch the outside corner. Home plate umpire Lance Walsh didn't see it that way, and the Rex took a 1-0 lead on the bases-loaded walk. Craig Shepard followed with a 2-run single for the Rex, and Eduardo Rodriguez blooped a single into right, giving Terre Haute a 4-0 lead and ending the night for Horter. "Ryan just didn't have his best stuff," Coleman said. In the bottom of the first, the Dans bounced back as Blake Powell drew a 2-out walk and Damon Pierce reached when he was hit by a pitch. That set up Christina Pena, whose first hit with Danville was a 3-run homer to left, pulling the Dans within 4-3. But that was as close as Danville would get. Terre Haute added 4 more runs in the second off of Danville reliever Cody Hawthorne, thanks to a couple of walks, 3 errors, and run-scoring hits from O'Leary and Whelan. "We have to do a better job of throwing strikes and playing better defense," Coleman said. The Dans got 1 run back in the bottom of the second on a sacrifice fly from Zach Huffins. That would be the final run of the game for Danville. Terre Haute put the game away with a 3-run third inning against Danville's Trevor Talpas. Once again, a walk and hit by pitch fueled the inning for the Rex. "The guys that came in after Horter didn't have good enough stuff to compete," Coleman said. "We have to do a better job of competing in the zone." Danville will attempt to snap its 5-game losing streak tonight at Danville Stadium in a 6:30 contest against the Lafayette Aviators. That's about all the time we have for today's reading. Thanks for joining me, and have a happy 4th of July.